I usually follow the lectionary, the Revised Common Lectionary, which lists Bible passages each week that correspond to the church year. And I follow the lectionary for a reason. It contains this three-year cycle of what the mainline church has determined are the most important Bible passages. The thinking is that if people are aware of these passages, they'll have a well-rounded concept of the Christian faith. While it's tempting to just pick out Bible texts week after week that suit whatever mood I'm in at the time, I recognize that I may not be careful enough or skillful enough to keep from giving you a very slanted view of the gospel. I follow the lectionary because it keeps me from falling into the trap of ignoring the gospel of Jesus Christ and delivering the gospel of Gary Cox, which I assure you would not stand the test of time. Each year in the lectionary's three-year cycle is dedicated to one of the three synoptic gospels. The Gospel of John, being so different from the others, is thrown in here and there throughout the three-year cycle. But Matthew, Mark, and Luke each have their own year. Matthew was the focus of last year's lectionary texts. And if you'll think back, you'll realize that most of the New Testament sermons I delivered last year were based on texts from the Gospel of Matthew. This is Luke's year. And again, most of the biblical sermons I've delivered this year have been based on Luke's gospel. One reason I mention this is that somebody told me he thought I was spending too much time over the past few months talking about the social gospel, with its emphasis on the poor and the oppressed, and its troubling questions about how fair it is that many of us, myself certainly included, have a much bigger share of the world's wealth than an objective view of the matter might permit. Well, there's a reason for my recent focus on the poor. Each of the four Gospels has its own characteristics, and the Gospel of Luke is the lectionary Gospel that is called the social Gospel. Remember, Matthew has Jesus say, "Blessed are the poor in spirit." Luke has Jesus say, "Blessed are the poor," period. Those are two very different things, the poor and the poor in spirit. Matthew has Jesus say, "Blessed are they who hunger for righteousness." Luke has Jesus say, "Blessed are they who hunger," period. There's a big difference in the way Matthew and Luke portray Jesus. Following the lectionary is the way I make sure that over time, the message I pass on from the pulpit does not overemphasize those parts of the Christian message I prefer, while omitting those parts of Jesus' teachings that I would just as soon personally ignore. I assured my friend that once Advent rolls around, we'll be off Luke and on to Mark, which is a mixed blessing. It's true that Luke tends to read like a social manifesto, but Bible scholar Tom Wright calls Mark's gospel a revolutionary tract. Anyway, all I can promise is that over time, you'll get the whole gospel message and not just the Coxian version of things. Here at UCC, we don't pay too much attention to the church year itself, and I'm glad of that. But I do like to keep you up to date. Over the past several Sundays, we spent a few weeks examining the book of Revelation, and then Dr. Myers did that great sermon on Numbers and the Bible. As we discussed these things, we passed by a few big days in the church year that I want to make you aware of. May 24th was, as you all know, I'm sure, Ascension Day. This is the day when the church celebrates the ascension of Jesus through the sky to sit at the right hand of God following his crucifixion and resurrection. Ascension Day is one of those days that most of us in the mainline church tend to ignore. To put it simply, we just don't think a physical Jesus walked around on the earth for 40 days after he was killed and then ascended through the sky to be with God. However, I should mention that there are a great number of very intelligent and highly spiritual people who do place a strong emphasis on Ascension Day. They manage to set aside the idea that everything in theology has to be grounded in physical facts and find the essence of the day to be meaningful and powerful. After Ascension Day came Pentecost, last Sunday, June 3rd. Pentecost was one of the three major Jewish feast days at the time of Jesus, and it today is celebrated by Christians as the day the Holy Spirit descended upon the apostles. More on that later. And then there's today, the first Sunday after Pentecost, which is known as Trinity Sunday. This is the day when ministers all over the world, bless their hearts, try to expound on the idea of the Trinity. I wrestled with writing a sermon on the Trinity and decided against it. Hold your applause, please. It's not that I don't think the Trinity is worth discussing or is an idea we should abandon, but it's summer. We made it through Memorial Day. The kids are out of school. We got our sights set on that upcoming vacation. I just didn't think most people would be in the mood for a heavy theological dissertation. Now, I personally find that conceiving of God as Father, Son, and Holy Spirit is a helpful way of thinking about God. But while the idea of the Trinity will hang in the background of today's message and surface occasionally, we'll leave the meat of that discussion for another time and concentrate on the Holy Spirit, because that's what Pentecost is all about. The church year is divided into six seasons: Advent, Christmas, Epiphany, Lent, Easter, and Pentecost. But the seasons aren't spaced evenly along the church year. In fact, the season of Pentecost, which began last Sunday, lasts for a full 6 months. It's half the year. So for those of you who don't like the church year, take comfort in the fact that I will not be advising you of another change in the church year until December 2nd, when the season of Advent arrives, and we're meant to start thinking about what it meant and what it means for Jesus to come into the world. The six-month season of Pentecost has another name: Ordinary Time. While the rest of the church year has us thinking about the arrival of Jesus, the birth of Jesus, the teachings of Jesus, the death and resurrection of Jesus, Pentecost is all about everyday life in the world in the presence of the Holy Spirit of God, a presence made possible by the grace of God which we see in Jesus. The New Testament tells us that the Holy Spirit has not always been among us, that Jesus promised to send the Holy Spirit into the world after his resurrection. And it further tells us that there is a specific time when the Holy Spirit arrived. 50 days after Jesus' death, the apostles gathered in Jerusalem for the Jewish celebration of Pentecost. I'll read the beginning of the story from the second chapter of Acts. When the day of Pentecost had come, they were all together in one place. And suddenly from heaven there came a sound like the rush of a violent wind, and it filled the entire house where they were sitting. Divided tongues as of fire appeared among them, and a tongue rested on each of them. All of them were filled with the Holy Spirit and began to speak in other languages as the Spirit gave them ability. Now there were devout Jews from every nation under heaven living in Jerusalem. And at this sound, the crowd gathered and was bewildered, because each one heard them speaking in the native language of each. Amazed and astonished, they asked, "Are not all of these who are speaking Galileans? How is it that we hear, each of us, in our own native language?" Well, the story goes on, and the amazed crowd soon comes to the conclusion that the apostles must be drunk. But Peter stands up and reminds the crowd that it's only 9 o'clock in the morning, assures everyone present that he and his friends are entirely sober, and he proceeds to preach the first great sermon of the new church. And that's why the day of Pentecost is considered important. It's the birthday of the church. It's the day when the presence of God in this world was perceived in a new way, the only way we've had, really, to perceive of God ever since. Ever since that time, we've realized that if we want to have contact with God, we don't need to travel beyond the stars or peek beyond the dome of the sky. our only contact with God is going to be the Holy Spirit of God we find within, and the Holy Spirit of God we find within other people. Looking elsewhere is a waste of time and energy. That story in Acts with the apostles speaking in strange languages is what led to the idea of speaking in tongues. The Pentecostal church, which is a fast-growing church full of people once called holy rollers, considers this speaking in tongues to be a sure sign that a person is experiencing the presence of God. And that's one of the reasons they call themselves Pentecostals. And I will not say all of that is nonsense. There's more to this world, and certainly more to the Christian faith, than I will ever be able to fully comprehend. But I will say that it doesn't make sense to me. I assume you've seen television shows and video clips of church celebrations where people speak in tongues. Sometimes it evolves into this almost mass hysteria as hundreds of people, eyes closed and heads raised to heaven above, deliriously babble streams of unintelligible gibberish. What seems so odd about all this to me is that it's just the opposite of what the Bible tells us happened at the first Pentecost. When this happens in church today, nobody has any idea what the person who is speaking in tongues is actually saying. But in the Bible story, the whole point is that people are able to understand what the apostles are saying. The gospel message being proclaimed for the very first time can be understood by people from all over the world. The apostles may not have known what they themselves were saying, but those around them did. The whole idea is that the gospel message is for everybody, regardless of where they are from and what their native language is. I'm not sure how that ties in with the idea that when people speak in tongues today, their message cannot be understood. But again, I would not definitively say modern speaking in tongues is silliness. I only state that I do not understand it in more ways than one. I don't understand it when I hear it, and I don't understand why God would try to speak to us in a language that holds no meaning for us. Moving on, the important thing about Pentecost is the Holy Spirit. My good friend Robin Myers, a person I believe our own Robert Myers has had occasion to associate with now and then, says that the loss of the Holy Spirit is the great tragedy of the modern liberal church. And I agree with him. We look at those Spirit-filled worshipers from other traditions, rolling in the aisles, waving their arms in the air, and babbling like toddlers who have stumbled across the communion wine, and we know instinctively we don't want any part of that nonsense. But what are we losing? The idea is that the one and only God relates to us in three ways. I'll give you an analogy. I am a husband. I am a father. I am a brother. I'm an uncle. I'm a nephew. I guess there's got to be at least five or six of me, right? Of course not. There's only one me, and I relate to the world around me in different ways. Or to put it more precisely, the world around me, the people in the world around me, view me in different ways depending on how they relate to me and I to them. But I'm still me in every case, and there's only one of me. Consider God. God is one. There is one Father, the creator of the universe, and there is one Son, the redeemer of everything in creation. And there is one Holy Spirit, the Spirit that sustains us and connects us to one another and to our Creator. But the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, the Creator, Redeemer, and Sustainer, is one. What we have are three ways of relating to the one God. I like the way some mystics address God in prayer. They say, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, Mother of us all. I like that because not only does it unify the three visions of God, it takes care of the patriarchal language problem as well. Now let me tell you why I think it's such a shame many of us have tossed aside the idea of the Holy Spirit. God the Father, the creator of the universe, is unknowable. Martin Luther called this the hidden God. Oh, we can speculate all over the place, and we do. We conjure up amazing theological dissertations and write dense philosophical books about this creating God, but we can never know this God. The information that would make this aspect of God knowable by the human mind has not been provided. Consider the Son, the Redeemer, Jesus Christ. This aspect of the triune God is knowable only through study. We can know Jesus the same way we know George Washington. We can read about him. We can listen to what people say about him. We can even pray for insights into his nature. But the man who walked the earth 2,000 years ago cannot physically sit down beside us and say, "Let me tell you about myself, so you will know of all the things that have been said of me, what's true and what's not." Now consider the Holy Spirit. The Holy Spirit is the one aspect of God, the only aspect of God, the only relationship between God and humanity that is truly knowable by us, by a person in the world today. And when I say knowable, I mean it can be known through experience. The Holy Spirit is God within us. And the Holy Spirit is the one aspect of God that seems to translate from religion to religion. I'll give you an example. In Hinduism, the soul is envisioned as having two parts. The jiva is the part of the soul attached to the individual, which in Hinduism changes over time according to the way one lives his or her life. This is the part of a person's soul Hindus believe is reincarnated. The other part of the soul is called the Atman. The Atman is pure spirit and cannot be differentiated from God. The Atman is unaffected by our individual lives. The Atman is the perfect and eternal spirit of God which lives inside us. Well, it doesn't take a lot of imagination to see that for all the differences in the religions of Christianity and Hinduism, they share the belief that we are connected to God inside in a special way. Each religion holds that God is an inner and knowable part of us, a part which Hindus call the Atman and which Christians call the Holy Spirit. Without the Holy Spirit, religion loses much of its meaning. One of the special things about Pentecost is that it reveals a God who is making a claim on our lives. For Christians, the Holy Spirit isn't something we earn. It isn't something we have a right to. It's a gift from God. It's God's gift of God to us. The arrival of the Holy Spirit is something that happened in time. God broke into history and made a claim on us. And this is one of the things I think that makes Christianity special. Many religions hold that time is a spiral, an eternal cycle, and has no beginning, it starts nowhere, it goes nowhere, and it never ends. Not Christianity. Christian theology holds this creation is created by God. And Christian theology holds there's a purpose to creation. We're not stuck on some eternal cosmic wheel. We're going somewhere. Life is a journey, not a trap. And there's a reason we're on this journey. Ultimately, life is a step on the way to a greater fulfillment, a fulfillment that's beyond our understanding, but with which our faith tells us makes the journey worthwhile, regardless of the wrong turns and the bumps in the road. And we have a helper on our journeys, none other than the God who created us in the first place, knowable by us because that creating and redeeming God lives within us and binds us not only to God, but to each other. It's no coincidence that the word spirit is translated as wind in ancient languages, both Hebrew and Greek. We can't see it, but we can feel it. It refreshes us. It can even move us if we yield to its currents. Pentecost tells us that God is with us, and we might as well just take every fear and throw it aside, and let the wind take us where it may. John's gospel says it so well. The wind blows where it will, and you hear the sound of it, but you do not know whence it comes or whither it goes. So it is with everyone who is born of the Spirit. Next week, we're going to talk about what it would mean to be born of the Spirit. We've all heard that we must be born again. If you've traveled to Kansas City lately, you've seen a dozen or so signs along the highway warning you to get born again or pay the consequences. I think you'll find that when we take a close look at the biblical passage in which we find that phrase, it may not mean what many people think it does. Between now and then, I hope you'll think about Pentecost. God has made a claim on us. Through Pentecost, we have been made aware that we are all on a road trip. But it's not a meaningless ride. We travel with purpose. We travel with one another, and we travel with the Holy Spirit of God. And God has given us a special way of traveling. We've been called to be disciples of Jesus. And that means the journey will be joyful and fulfilling and meaningful, but it doesn't mean the journey will be easy. Remember, of the original disciples, all but John were killed, martyred for believing what they believed, for living the way they lived, for traveling through this world the way they did. Pentecost tells us that something has happened to this world. God has done something decisive. God has become known, or at least knowable. God is right here, right now, waiting for us in this present moment. And that makes this present moment sacred. Pentecost tells us that all the promises of the past and all of our hopes for the future are wrapped in the beauty of this present moment. The very moment we now share is brought forth by God, is redeemed by Christ, and is filled to overflowing with God's Holy Spirit. And that is good news. In fact, that is the good news, the gospel. And it is the joy of my life to share it with you.